Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on Blue World News.
Our top story, Hezbollah has carried out fresh retaliatory operations against Israeli military targets deep inside occupied territory. In one of the operations, a group targeted the Shraga military base north occupied city of Aqqa with rockets. Hezbollah also targeted the Tel Nof air base south of Tel Aviv with missiles. The resistance movement said it targeted Israel's Hahotrim base for a first time with rockets as well. The Yeknoim illicit factory, the southeast of Haifa, was also hit. The group also targeted several gatherings of Israeli forces in a number of settlements. Now, Hezbollah has managed to inflict heavy losses on Israeli occupation forces since the regime began its aggression into Lebanon back in October 2023. The group has so far destroyed over 40 Merkava tanks, several military bulldozers, armored vehicles, and Israeli drones, and over 100 Israeli soldiers have so far been killed and over 1,000 injured by Hezbollah fighters. And earlier, our Beirut correspondent Maddie Amsala updated us on latest Israeli attacks on Lebanon and also Hezbollah's retaliatory operations against Israeli military targets.
The Israelis are systematically destroying the southern suburbs of Beirut. Today, there were 13 strikes on South Beirut, in addition to the targeting and the destruction of the southern parts of the country, especially the areas near the border. Now, Hezbollah has made it clear that as long as the aggression continues, they will not stop their operations, which they also seem to mention in every single statement that it's also in support of the Palestinian people and their resistance. Today, Hezbollah, and as always, it seems every day is Hezbollah is diversifying their operations, the type of operations, the quality and the quantity of their rockets, and the type, of course, of armor that they're using. They're also using drones, which have become a clear challenge to the Israelis. Now, Hezbollah has said that they targeted for the very first time the Yakimat elite, military base, which is a technological factory. It's also responsible for, of course, a lot of the military industry for the Israelis, which they, of course, usually boast about. This is 50 kilometers away from the Lebanese border in the southeast of Haifa, which is quickly transforming into another Kiryat Shmona, as Hezbollah had promised. They also targeted the Al-Manara area, or Israeli forces in the Al-Manara base at least three times, in addition to Al-Abad base.
In one of the deadliest attacks, at least six Palestinians were killed and several wounded after Israeli warplanes bombed a residential building in Nusayra refugee camp in central Gaza. Israeli jets also bombed a tent housing displaced Palestinians in Deir al-Bala, also in the central part of the besieged strip, leaving a number of Palestinians dead and injured there. To the north, Israeli forces targeted a house in the city of Beit Lahia, which also led to the deaths of several Palestinians. Northern Gaza has been the focal point of unrelenting Israeli air and artillery strikes, as well as a crippling siege for over a month now. Since Israeli aggression began October last year, over 43,600 Palestinians have been killed and over 103,000 injured. And for your update, we checked in with our Gaza correspondent earlier, Moti Abu Musabe, from the central city of Deir al-Bala.
Well, let me begin with the fish massacre that took place moments ago in Deir al-Bala city after the Israeli fighter drones attacked the tents of the Palestinian people in the Al-Bassa area in the western part of Deir al-Bala city, killing at least two Palestinian civilians and injuring multiple others. In addition to that, a big fire erupted and engulfed several tents of the Palestinian displaced in that area. When it comes to Al-Nusrat refugee camp, the Israeli occupation forces carried out an airstrike against a residential building in the northern part of Al-Nusrat refugee camp, killing six Palestinian civilians. Needless to mention that the Israeli artillery shelling was maintained heavily and brutally against the northern part of Al-Nusrat refugee camp. We are still hearing several and deafening explosions of those attacks being launched against the Palestinian residential buildings. And as you know, the Israeli occupation forces on the ground continue to detonate and dynamite more residential buildings there. The current situation is still excruciating and catastrophic for the Palestinian people, particularly in Al-Nusrat refugee camp, because it is considered as one of the most crowded areas across all areas of Gaza Strip, because it is completely overcrowded with the displaced people, particularly when it comes to the northern part of Al-Nusrat refugee camp.
Top UN official has condemned worsening humanitarian crisis in Gaza, describing Israeli violations against Palestinians as acts reminiscent of the gravest international crimes.
We are witnessing acts reminiscent of the gravest international crimes. Ambulances have been destroyed and hospitals have come under attack. Supplies to the north are being cut off and people are being pushed farther south. The daily cruelty we see in Gaza seems to have no limits.
Joyce Msuya made a statement at the UN Security Council meeting on Palestine. She condemned Israel's military recent escalations in northern Gaza, noting civilians have been driven from their homes and often forced to witness deaths of their family members. UN official raised alarm over Israeli Knesset's recent bill, which banned activities of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA. She urged UN member states to use diplomatic and economic pressure to prevent further suffering of the Palestinian people. The Security Council meeting came after a recent UN-backed report warned of imminent and substantial likelihood of famine in the blockaded Palestinian territory. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the U.S. for complicity in Israel's Gaza genocide, and this after Washington said Israel was not violating U.S. law on level of aid entering the territory. Hamas said Israel is deceiving the international community by creating a false impression of aid deliveries. Movement said, however, regime continues its campaign of ethnic cleansing, genocide, and starvation, exploiting the world's indifference to its crimes. The resistance group called for immediate end to regime's atrocities, especially in northern Gaza, where a heavy siege is underway for over a month now. The remarks come as earlier Tuesday, the Biden administration claimed that Israel had taken measures to improve delivery of humanitarian aid into Gaza, and therefore Washington will continue its arms transfers to the regime. Iran's foreign minister has warned the U.S. against resumption of its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran, stressing Washington's previous attempts to oppress Iran only failed. On his ex account, Abbas Araghchi said first version of maximum pressure was met with maximum resistance, resulting in Washington's maximum defeat. He pointed to Iran's advances in peaceful nuclear program after U.S. imposed unilateral sanctions back in 2018. He instead called for maximum wisdom, which he said will benefit everyone. The warning comes following reports that U.S. President-elect Donald Trump is considering imposing further sanctions on Tehran after taking office in January. Back in 2018 and during his first term, Trump launched what he called a maximum pressure campaign against the country after unilaterally withdrawing from an international accord on Iran's nuclear program. Researcher and political analyst Christopher Helali says that U.S. unilateral sanctions have prompted Iran to become more independent, expanding its strategic partnership with non-Western countries.
It resulted in the victory that Iran is now a key player in the development of a multipolar world, that Iran is a key member of the BRICS, and that it participates now in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization there. And of course, that it's a key member of this resistance, not only to regional powers like the Zionist entity, but also to Western hegemony overall. And so the victory of the Trump administration was making Iran even stronger, even more self-sufficient, and less reliant on the West. And so if they continue on this path, we will only see a deepening and a strengthening of Iran's ongoing strategic partnerships with Russia, with China, and with other countries, both neighboring countries as well as countries far beyond.
Yemeni armed forces continue retaliatory operations against U.S. warships in the Red and Arabian Seas in support of the Palestinian and Lebanese people. Here's an announcement by Brigadier General Yahya Ansari, spokesperson for the Yemeni Armed Forces.
In retaliation to the American-British aggression against our country and in continuation of supporting the Palestinian and Lebanese people, the missile and UAV forces of the Yemeni armed forces carried out two specific military operations. The first operation targeted the American aircraft carrier Abraham, located in the Arabian Sea, with a number of cruise missiles and drones. The operation has successfully achieved its objectives and led to thwarting the operation that the American enemy was preparing against our country. The other operation targeted two American destroyers in the Red Sea with a number of ballistic missiles and drones. The operation has successfully achieved its objectives. Accordingly, the Yemeni armed forces hold the American and British enemy responsible for turning the Red Sea region into a zone of military tension and its repercussions on maritime navigation. Launching an aggression against Yemen within the American-British defensive actions of the Israeli enemy by the American warships will only push the Yemeni armed forces to further use their legitimate right to defend, confront, and strike all hostile threats in the Red Sea and Arab Seas and in any other region that Yemeni weapons reach. The operations of the Yemeni armed forces will not stop until the aggression on Gaza is stopped, the siege is lifted, and the aggression on Lebanon is stopped.
Yusuf Mowry joined us earlier from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, with more on country's latest anti-U.S. operation.
Based on the tracking and the monitoring and intelligence gathering by Yemen security and intelligence and by Yemen's army and armed forces, they were able to make a strategic, calculated determination that these U.S. Ships were engaging in hostile acts, which propelled the Yemeni army to launch these attacks with the purpose and the main goal of thwarting the U.S. plan to engage in a series of aerial raids across Yemen. Of course, over the past couple of days, we've all witnessed that the U.S. has intensified its military campaign here in Yemen. They've targeted Hodeidah a number of times. They've targeted the central province of Al-Baydah a number of times. And they even targeted the capital, Sana'a. They also launched two airstrikes in the northern province of Sa'dah. So for some reason, after President-elect Trump was voted to become the U.S. next president, these military escalations from the U.S. have intensified. But I can tell you that, according to Yemen's Ansar Allah movement, they don't care if it's Trump in office, they don't care if it's Harris in office, they don't even care if it's George Washington, if he's resurrected and rules over the U.S. If you enable genocide in Palestine, and if you allow Israel to continue massacring people in Palestine, there's repercussions.
Now, moving on to Amsterdam, where the Dutch capital has seen yet another round of police crackdown against pro-Palestine protesters. Demonstration on Monday night turned violent when police in riot gear used force to disperse demonstrators. Situation escalated after an electric train caught fire, but police did not specify reason behind the blaze. Earlier in the day, police rounded up hundreds of people who gathered at city's Dam Square, defying a ban on demonstrations. Tensions are high in Amsterdam since last week, following a football match between a Tel Aviv club and an Amsterdam club. Some Israeli fans were caught on camera tearing up Palestinian flags and vandalizing people's homes with Palestinian flags in front of them and chanting discriminatory anti-Arab slogans. And in response, pro-Palestine activists clashed with the Israelis, prompting police to intervene. Calls for Paris to cut all military supplies and take a tougher stance against Israel have so far fallen on deaf ears, officially at least. Peter Hume has been gauging the public opinion and has this report from the French capital.
To some, France is standing idly by as Gaza and its population are destroyed by what many consider to be Israeli genocide. Tabiazi is a Palestinian refugee from Gaza.
What I want from the French government and what I want from the French people and all of the world, just to give the Palestinians the same human rights. The Palestinians want to be free, just want to be has their freedom.
I want the French government to stop, completely cut all ties with Israel. I want the French government to recognize Palestine. I want the French government to stop being hypocrites and actually play a role in making the change.
Harsh words calling for tough actions, which are unlikely to be taken up by the government here. As Israeli artillery continues to pound Gaza and parts of South Lebanon, France says it no longer supplies Israelis with the military equipment being used on those two fronts. A statement met with skepticism by some. The visit of the highly controversial Israeli minister Bezalel Smotrich for a private gala seems set to go ahead, as does a football match later this week between France and Israel.
While sports are often seen as a unifying factor, this match is now under scrutiny as a potential flashpoint of unrest and protest, especially given the current situation in Lebanon and Palestine. Peter Hume at the Stade de France near Paris.
Pro-Palestine demonstrators have gathered outside a British university to support a visit by the UN Special Rapporteur for Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese. Outspoken UN Special Envoys on tour of British universities to discuss the human rights and Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. Saeed Pariza has your story out of London.
Francesca Albanese, the high-profile UN Special Rapporteur on a tour of British universities, paying a short visit to supporters outside London's Queen Mary University ahead of a speech inside. We asked her what message she had brought to the UK.
The UK is in breach of its international law obligations. It's in good companies because many countries are not abiding by international law right now. Israel is committing a genocide. It's not only me saying that. It's hundreds of legal experts, historians, genocide scholars, including from Israel. There are 30 experts of the United Nations saying that. There is the International Court of Justice recognizing the plausibility of a genocide. Why the UK is still trading weapons with Israel?
As she headed to the venue of her lecture, she was confronted by an Israel supporter who was escorted away by police.
There are two protests taking place, one by a small pro-Israel crowd accusing the UN rapporteur of anti-Semitism, and another one by a pro-Palestinian crowd who say they consider Francesca Albanese as a hero and a champion for human rights.
Since her arrival in the UK, the attacks on Ms. Albanese from pro-Israel groups have been relentless but futile. As the UN Special Rapporteur, Albanese has spent years reminding the world of what international law says about the rights and responsibilities of the occupier and the occupied. Ahead of her visit to the UK, she published a report accusing Israel of committing genocide and apartheid. That drew the wrath of not just Israel, but its main backer, the United States, with outgoing Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield accusing Albanese of anti-Semitism and calling for her dismissal from the UN. Israel's smear campaigns against Albanese predate October 7th. Not one to be silenced, she's gone in the other direction, and by doing so, inspired more global Palestine solidarity. Saeed Pariza, London.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor has accused the Zionist regime of intentionally wanting to destroy the Palestinian population. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, Euromed, warned recently that 400,000 Palestinians will be starved to death if they are not killed by Israeli occupation forces' relentless military operation in northern Gaza. The rights group said in a statement that Israel's obstruction of aid entry to the north for the last several weeks, along with the massive military operation it is carrying out in the area, have not only placed Palestinians at high risk of being killed by bombardment, but also added starving the population to death. The statement read, "Due to the ongoing Israeli siege, about 200,000 Palestinians in the northern Gaza governorate have been without food or drinking water for 10 full days now." The statement added, "This is occurring as the Israeli army continues its invasion of the region, killing over 350 Palestinians and injuring hundreds more, while also destroying numerous homes and residential buildings." The international organization revealed that dozens of trapped Palestinians in the Jabalia refugee camp were targeted by Israeli occupation forces when they sought to secure food from the United Nations Refugees and Relief Agency Supply Center. The statement said, "The Israeli army targeted them with shells and quadcopter drones, killing 10 people and injuring at least 40 more. Many of the victims are still lying in the streets and cannot be taken to the hospital due to the threat of further Israeli violence." Euromed accused the Israeli occupation authorities of using food as a weapon in the ongoing genocide due to its decision to ban any food entry to the north. The statement said, "Given Israel's declared decision to bar any aid from entering northern Gaza, which is the site of one of its biggest crimes of starvation, the survivors of this intense shelling are in danger of starvation, Israel's use of starvation as a lethal weapon." It added that such Israeli actions are meant to truly destroy the Palestinian population and come to illustrate its blatant intent to continue carrying out the genocide it has been committing for more than a year in the Gaza Strip. Euromed revealed that thousands of the residents in Jabalia, Beit Lahia, and Beit Hanun are trapped with no access to food or water. Israeli occupation forces have banned aid entry in northern Gaza weeks before it launched its latest military operations in the area. The statement stressed many of the trapped residents had already been repeatedly forced from their homes and shelters, leaving behind personal possessions and food supplies each time they flee. The rights organization disclosed that the Euromed team has succeeded in documenting during the last 10 days hundreds of Israeli raids and shellings that have targeted homes, shelters and streets in northern Gaza. According to the statement, many victims and injured people are still stuck in the streets or homes as they cannot be transported to hospitals. This is because Israeli forces have banned ambulances from moving through most of Jabalia and its camp. Euromed added that the only two hospitals that can still receive Palestinians in that area are the Kamal Adwan Hospital and Al Auda Hospital, which are working under extremely difficult conditions and limited resources. The rights organization demanded that the United Nations and the international community at large exert instant efforts to allow life-saving aid into the northern Gaza and to halt its genocide against Palestinians across the entire Gaza Strip. It urged for a comprehensive arms embargo on the Tel Aviv regime to save the lives of thousands of Palestinians in the Strip and hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes. The UN World Food Programme, WFP, has announced no food aid has entered northern Gaza since October 1st, affecting thousands of Palestinian families. In a statement, WFP said food distribution points, as well as kitchens and bakeries in North Gaza, have been forced to shut down due to Israeli airstrikes, military ground operations, and evacuation orders. the only functioning bakery in North Gaza, caught fire after being hit by an explosive munition. Anthony Renard, WFP country director for Palestine, said the north is basically cut off and we are not able to operate there. Flouting a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire, the Zionist regime has faced international condemnation amid its continued brutal offensive on Gaza. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for Genocide Against Palestinians, the Zionist regime has been waging a devastating war on Gaza since October 7, 2023. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, at least 42,289 Palestinians have been murdered and at least 98,684 wounded in Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza starting on October 7, 2023. Moreover, at least 11,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime says that 1,200 of its troops and civilians were killed during the Al-Aqsa storm operation on October 7. Israeli media published reports suggesting that many Israelis were killed on that day by friendly fire. Palestinian and international organizations say that the majority of the Palestinians wounded and murdered are women and children. The Israeli regime war has resulted in acute famine, mostly in northern Gaza, resulting in the death of many Palestinians, mostly children. The Israeli regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all over the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into the densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Later in the war, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians began moving from south to central Gaza in a constant search for safety.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Sheikh Rouhani and
Brother Muhammad.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muhammad. Welcome
to the show. Wa alaikum assalam.
All right, for today's episode, we want to talk about an interesting topic, identity crisis. Especially in today's world, with all these migrations from Muslim lands to the secular one and the reverse migration that is taking place. Fortunately, of course, so many Muslims are getting back to their homelands, you know, and this is a good news. Some people might say that psychologically speaking, they are facing a kind of identity crisis. Religiously speaking, they belong to Abrahamic religions, but in their lifestyle, maybe they will act as a secular one. But Brother Muhammad, we are living in a global village, aren't we?
Yeah.
I mean, with all the social media and all. For example, a person who is living in far, far places of rural areas of a Muslim land can reach a lifestyle, luxurious lifestyle, yeah, of a completely full Westerner. Doesn't it make any crisis in his, awareness, in his knowledge around, about surrounding, about the world around him or her?
Yes, of course. You see, this really comes back to the upbringing of that person, mm-hmm, within the family setting. That's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as Sheikh rightfully mentioned, when you are self-centric, you look upon yourself only. But then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions in the Quran, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا قُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا. Save yourselves and your families from the hellfire. And when you bring this commandment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala into picture, saying that you're not the only person who you are you're responsible to save yourself from the hellfire, your family as well. When you take this into consideration, you understand that from the childhood, you have responsibility of your children.
All right.
Make sure that they are brought up in a way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has taught you, that the Prophet had taught you, that the Imams have given you the examples of.
There's still a place for questioning your beliefs, which are given to you through your parents. I mean, you inherited them from them, isn't it? still there are some places, there must be a place for questioning, for doubting, isn't it? For some of the fixed ideas and the rituals. I mean, are these questions dangerous? Are they satanic temptations or no? They're completely rational, Sheikh.
You know, let me disagree with you in this regard, okay, saying that...
Now, of course, this is a question rather than a comment, sorry. I have to put myself in the place of not knowing anything by the producer, Mr. Mahmoud. Yes. Sorry. This is only a question, not a comment.
Of course, we cannot say that, Islamically talking, you know what I wanted to say is from the Islamic perspective, right. I do not want to whether the other religions, other schools, say, but Islamically talking, the main Islamic beliefs, the main principial and fundamental beliefs in Islam, all Muslims have this duty and responsibility to study and to learn and to acquire enough knowledge and to accept these main beliefs rationally, mm-hmm. logically, intellectually, right. reasonably, I mean. It is not something that you imitate or follow blindly, for example, your society, your community, your teachers, your parents, your relatives. No, of course not. That is why, for example, monotheism or oneness of God, Tawheed, which is the most principal belief in Islam, every Muslim has this duty to understand that monotheism is right, is true. It's not false. Since it is true and it is not false, they should believe in this. Mm-hmm. Not to follow, for example, certain marja or even certain imam, even certain prophet.
All right.
You know, when you believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in oneness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it should be something that you believe in rationally. If you go, for example, to the Muslim philosophers, Muslim theologians, the Muslim scholars, you see in their works, they discuss these issues completely rationally, not referring to any single ayah, any single verse, any single hadith.
Right.
First, they prove that there is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is one. Then this Allah sent us the prophets and the imams that we have to follow.
Okay.
Then we follow them.
So even with the modern rationality of the modern man, you know, there must not be a kind of identity crisis, isn't it?
Sorry, what?
You mean if the modern man is going to even ask rational questions, isn't it, about your religious faith and the religious beliefs, on that time there would be even not a single iota of a problem for identity crisis, isn't it?
It itself is not a problem. You know, when you ask about the main...
Because you know yourself, you know your God.
About the main Islamic beliefs, everyone has, Muslims and non-Muslims, to ask that why is it true? And what are your proofs, your arguments? How can you prove that this is true or false, for example? So then Muslims basically or fundamentally believe in Islam this way.
All right.
When it comes to the secondary issues, to furu'at, yes, in those areas, we follow some scholars, experts, professionals.
All right.
That's true. But in the main principal beliefs in Islam, we should believe in them completely rationally.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we suggest to even non-Muslims, that you shouldn't think that Muslims believe in Islam, believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, believe in God, because, for example, their prophet, because their community, their society, their teachers, relatives, parents say that. This is wrong. If a Muslim believe in God because of his parents, because of his relatives, because of his teacher, that's false. Mm-hmm. That's wrong. He's not a true Muslim.
Okay. We have the phenomenon of reverse migration of some of the Muslims who migrate and pass into the Western world to their own homelands now. When you ask them about the major, we can't say reason, they say that we want to our children, especially to grow up, because we are facing all these contradictions, you know, in the Western world. Hijab is one of them, shaking hands with a non-mahram, working in a workplace for the women, especially going to schools. Gender direction, I mean orientation or something like that, you know, all these we can say
reasons,
that's right, reasons around, you know, the children even for example at schools are facing many problems, the Muslim ones, so they want to get back to their Muslim lands in order to stop their child from being born by I cannot call it bipolar, because bipolar is a name of disease, but I mean, in these, we can say, that's right, bi-dimensional, it's better to say,
exactly.
We can say character improvement. Is it good? Is it a good way to go?
So let me start from a different perspective. Hidayah and guidance is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I've seen many brothers and sisters who live in the West and are even better guided, and even their upbringing is even better than many people who are living in the Muslim countries. So it's not necessarily the country or the environment. Yes, it has a lot of effect. It has a lot of, it affects the persons separately, differently, on how they're abroad. Like, for example, I know many of the Shia brothers and sisters who do not live close to Islamic centers, and they do not go to the majalis so often. And then when they come to Islamic countries, they're root countries, and they realize, oh, look at how majlis is performed. They really don't know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know the culture of the majalis. It has a lot of effect.
Okay.
But the guidance itself, yes, moving oneself towards the right path and following that right path, the straight path, mm-hmm, it's not necessarily affected, or not necessarily the main, the moving factor is, yes, not the actual motivation, place where you live.
Yes.
It's actually your guidance, which comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As Sheikh rightfully mentioned, families, they have a role in upbringing the children until the intellectual maturity.
Okay.
Once there is an intellectual maturity, the families have responsibilities to give the children the rationality. Let them think. Let them bring that rational for themselves. Every child, I can remember once I was speaking to one of the grade 2, grade 3 children, and surprising that this new generation, how clever they are sometimes. you think that these guys, they're now developing, but they've already, kind of matured intellectually. Right. You're saying, I asked them, how do you know that God exists? I just look at the trees and I see the leaf falling. And then I realize that these leaf, when they fall, they become manure, they become compost for the tree itself. And then they take that same leaf that shedded from that tree and became a compost soil for that tree is now taking back that energy back to itself. I realized its cycle is there, but something had to start before this could ever take place.
Uh-huh.
It's the young grade 3 child.
Okay.
Right? Something took place for this tree to now grow up and then shed and then continue this cycle. I see us humans like this. We have generations after generations, but something started it, and I realized that there's nothing other than God. You understand, mm-hmm, what I mean? So
yes,
that rationality, that creative growth must be instilled in that in the minds of the children, not only Muslims, generally. Anyone who is after the truth.
Yes.
I'm not saying the upbringing of Muslims should be like this, but generally, from a human perspective, the upbringing of every child should be rational. Once they reach the intellectual maturity, let them think. Let them give them the means to think and the freedom to think, and let them make conclusions for themselves. And inshallah, with the guidance from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if that child was abroad properly,
right,
then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of course, the guidance will come to them, and they'll be able to steer their, maneuver, right, their way around identity crisis, mm-hmm, as easy,
inshallah,
as possible.
So if I want to have a faithful lifestyle as a Muslim in the Western world and not facing identity crisis, what should I do? And I'm not able to get back to my homeland, for example, to living, for example, in a country which the Islamic rulings are observed. What should I do?
One of the very important term that I want to mention here, and I suggest to brothers, particularly Muslim brothers and sisters in non-Islamic countries, to think about it and to study a bit about it. Ta'arrub ba'd al-Islam. This is a technical term.
Yes.
Ta'arrub ba'd al-Islam. They should study about this. This is a real, a serious problem, serious challenge that Muslims who live in non-Islamic countries, they may face. So I think, first of all, it is the duty and responsibility of the parents,
mm-hmm,
to bring up their children in an Islamic atmosphere or environment, or what we can say, condition. What I mean is this, that, when you have a child and he is not intellectually mature, or let's say
grown up
perfect,
enough,
okay, here you have to teach them some things that you think it is your duty and it is your Islamic responsibility. For example, you have to teach your children the Tawheed, Nabuwa, Imama, Adala, Ma'at, Qiyam, all these things.
All right.
When at the time of the childhood, they should learn these things.
Mm-hmm.
You have to teach them.
All right.
Now, since these principles of Islam are completely rational, pure, let's say, intellectual and logical, once they reach the level of puberty and maturity, then they would think about it. They will think about it because they will see lots of other ism, mm-hmm. other religions, other schools. Yes. Okay? They will face. You do not have any other alternative. They would face. Then at that time, you cannot force them, you cannot pressurize them to come back to Islam if you do not teach them in their childhood the principles of Islam.
All right.
So that's why at that time, it is their choice. They will decide either to follow this side or that side. But in the childhood, you have to teach them. This is your duty. You know? Because if you do not make them familiar with these principles of Islam, once they reach the level of maturity and they see lots of ism here and there, they will not be able to decide which side is true, which one is true, because that's too late.
All right.
So that's why Islam tells us that the Holy Prophet وسلم, says that الْوَلَدُ يُولَدُ عَلَى الْفِطْرَةِ فَإِنَّ أَبَوَاهُ يُهَوِّذَانَهُ وَيُنَسَّرَانَهُ وَيُمَجِّسَانَهُ. So it says that الْوَلَدُ, الطفل, the baby is born by the divine nature, by the heavenly nature.
Right.
Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put this divine or heavenly guidance inside him.
Right.
The point is that you should attract his attention to this guidance in the childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Then once he become a perfect man, for example, a 20 years old man, in that case, if he had this background, then he would better decide whether to follow, for example, this religion, that school, or this school. Even at that time, he would have this capability or, let's say, capacity to think about it, to ponder on it, to reflect about these kind of issues, and at least to refer to some scholars.
All right.
That, oh, great scholars, I've learned these things, and now I'm facing these things. I'm a little bit confused that which one should I follow?
Okay.
But if you do not teach anything Islamically in the childhood to your children, once they reach that age, what will happen?
All right.
They will not care about Islam.
They would never refer
to any Islamic studies, any scholar, because they will be bombarded by this new kind of information, new misconceptions, misguidance.
Mm-hmm.
This is the problem that it is really serious. It's really challenging. Our Muslim brothers, parents in non-Islamic countries, they should be very much cautious and careful about these kind of problems.
Working on the roots. That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani. And Brother Muhammad, for a nice elaboration with our identity crisis. Was very kind of you. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for being with us in the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Free Palestine.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Recently, Israeli traveling fans in Amsterdam tore down Palestinian flags and shouted racist abuse in latest manifestation of appalling behavior by a society that celebrates mass slaughter and genocide. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, human history is full of examples of genocidal acts committed by leaders, states, militaries, and armed groups. But the genocide unfolding before our eyes in Gaza stands out for its level of meticulous documentation and the speed of information flow. Billions of people around the world receive live, uncensored coverage of what is happening in the besieged Gaza Strip from the perspectives of both victim and aggressor. As we witness the massive scale of destruction and killing, it is essential to note the development of a culture of genocide within the Zionist society. One of its most recent manifestations took place recently when Israeli hooligans, supporters of Maccabi Tel Aviv Football Club, provoked clashes with Dutch youth in Amsterdam. They chanted anti-Arab slogans, tore down Palestinian flags, and ignored a minute of silence for the Spanish flood victims. It apparently never occurred to these Israeli hooligans that racist chanting and acts of vandalism against private property in a foreign country was unacceptable behavior, which could provoke the anger of local residents. The hooligans' mindset aligns with the genocidal culture that has permeated Israeli society since October 7, 2023, allowing the Zionists to imagine themselves as being above the law and morality, not only in Israel, but the world over. The violent chants of Maccabi fans should be understood within the context of a society that continues to justify the Zionist regime's genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. These fans are an expression of a culture that is not just prevalent among a handful of racists. Rather, it has become routine in stadiums with chants of death to Arabs or may your village burn, often heard in Israel long before October 7, 2023. The behavior of the Zionist fans in Amsterdam was thus nothing new. A recent report by the New Israel Fund found a significant increase in expressions of violence in football stadiums in 2023 to 2024 season, with incidents rising by 18%, a significant increase over the previous year, which had already seen violence and racism reach a decade-high peak. The real story here is therefore not the racist chants, but the shock of Zionist fans at the realization that such behavior is not tolerated outside Palestine borders. This comes at a time when, for more than a year, cultural codes and rituals have been invoked in Israel to promote and encourage genocide, with limited public criticism, justifications for the killing of Palestinian children, and the starvation of civilians in Gaza have received widespread endorsement. Last month, Al Jazeera published a documentary focusing on social media posts by Zionist troops in Gaza who documented their war crimes in real time. While much of the world was horrified by this material, Zionist society defended the troops and attacked critics for questioning the Zionist regime's right to defend itself. Zionist society is trapped in a state of political dissonance, which limits its ability to understand the logical flaws in such arguments. To understand how we got here, one must pay attention to the regime's culture of genocide, which is based on a set of beliefs and customs that encourage, justify, and even celebrate the Zionist regime's actions. Over the past year, we have been exposed to songs, comedy, performances, journalistic broadcasts, and cultural displays, along with commentary from religious leaders, football players, and academics that has openly promoted genocide, including the killing of children. Israeli analysts have not held back on calling for the slaughter of tens of thousands of Palestinians, with some saying the army should be killing more people or removing all humanitarian aid from Gaza. Instead of condemning and denouncing such statements, academics and commentators have philosophized on how to justify starving a civilian population if it refuses to comply with the Zionist regime military orders. Thus, beyond the horrifying testimonies emerging from Gaza, we must examine the mechanisms at work within Israeli society. In some ways, we are witnessing a collective psychotic episode, with many apparently unable to feel sympathy or empathy over the suffering of others. Even worse, this phenomenon is present everywhere in the public sphere. Walking along Israeli streets and listening to conversations among people of all ages on trains and in public parks reveals broad underlying assumption about the war in Gaza, with a collective cry for more death and destruction. Lifeguards on beaches in Tel Aviv have publicly cheered the death of Hamas and Hezbollah leaders, while members of the public clapped and raised glasses in celebratory toast. Some residents distributed baklava to mark the occasion, to exacerbate the sense of dystopia. This is all happening in a society where many civilians are armed. One could argue that the Zionist regime's political and cultural elites are responsible for framing the public mindset, laying the groundwork for this culture of genocide. In addition, the international community has, for the better part of a century, allowed the Zionist regime to act freely, violating international law with zero accountability. In fact, the world has rewarded the child killer regime of Israel for its creativity in developing oppressive mechanisms. The Zionist regime's arms industry has thrived amid the occupation, with Palestinians serving as test subjects. Israeli universities have grown and flourished, providing infrastructure and research on how to suppress Palestinians, while Arab states have promoted normalization with the Zionist regime. Israeli society has thus internalized a sense of impunity, safe in the knowledge that it is above the law, with the world's support. This has fueled the evolution of its culture of genocide. This culture of genocide is likely to be reinforced by the return of U.S. President Donald Trump to the White House. It is expected that Trump will continue his country's unprecedented support for the Zionist regime's war machine, encouraging the culture of genocide. The right in Israel was quick to celebrate Trump's victory, not because of future military or diplomatic aid, but because a president like Trump is expected to permit the starvation of Palestinians in Gaza, while turning a blind eye to all anti-democratic legislation that Israel is passing aimed solely at harming the Palestinian people. This includes the Zionist regime's ban on UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, the expulsion of families whose relatives have committed security offensives, and the disqualification of Arab politicians from holding elected office if they made statements that could be interpreted as supporting an armed struggle. This war will end one day, but as long as there is no fundamental critique of the Zionist regime's conduct, the culture of genocide, in addition to the devastation it continues to wreak on the Palestinian people, will start exacting a price from Israelis themselves.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hezbollah continues anti-Israel operations in occupied territories, striking three major military bases near Haifa and Tel Aviv with rockets and drones. A senior UN official condemns Israel's atrocities in Gaza, saying the regime's actions are reminiscent of the gravest international crimes. And Iran warns the U.S. not to repeat its failed maximum pressure policy against Tehran, saying it will only result in maximum defeat.